David Boeri, it's here and now. It's the traditional handshakes today in Detroit and Dearborn as the United Auto Workers Union begins formal negotiations with car makers Ford and GM. Talks with Chrysler begin on Friday. What's on the agenda, though, is anything but traditional. Beleaguered U.S. automakers are looking for big changes to reduce their health care and wage costs, and changes in workplace rules to increase productivity. Some analysts are calling these the most critical negotiations in the history of the Auto Workers Union. The current auto workers' contract runs out on September 14th. With us is Micheline Maynard, Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And Mickey, is it fair to say that health care costs are at the top of the agenda?
I think so. And what I think people should understand is it isn't necessarily active health care costs. It's what's called legacy costs, which is the amount that the car makers have to pay for both the current liability and the future liability. And one of the reasons why their debt ratings are so bad on Wall Street is that they face this large obligation going forward for health care.
Well, they call them legacy costs. Other people call them, the workers call them, promises. Here's an article that you wrote last week. You're quoting a retiree. He says, this is what we were promised. You're going to have a pension. You're going to have health care. Well, now all of a sudden things have changed and they want to take it away. Isn't there an element of fairness in this, despite how expensive it is?
Well, absolutely. And I always say that there are two signatures on every contract. There's the union signature and management signature. And, you know, the car makers agreed to these. And, in fact, the fully paid health care has been in place for decades. When these car makers were dominating the American industry and selling especially a lot of big SUVs and pickups, these costs were really not in question.
Well, the three automakers have lost, what, $15 billion in 2006. Auto workers represented the best of deals that American workers had in recent years. But now it seems that the automakers are pulling out those numbers, and those numbers, to argue their case, are pretty mind-boggling.
They are mind-boggling, but, you know, this whole setup, the labor contract, the whole labor negotiation setup, was really established in the post-World War II era, when there were no Japanese automakers building cars in the United States. You know, just compare the contracts. First of all, there isn't a contract at, say, the Toyota plant in Kentucky, whereas the UAW contract with the big three companies in Detroit is the size of the Manhattan phone book.
You've written that there's a conflict of interest within the UAW because of these retirees. So how does this play into negotiations?
Well, the union goes into these negotiations for the first time with more retired workers in their ranks than active workers in their ranks. And it's the retirees that the car companies say are actually posing the heaviest costs. And so that would set up a situation where people would say, well, naturally, you cut back on retiree costs. But as the people I've interviewed have said, these are things that are owed to us. This is why we stayed 35 years working in a car plant. And frankly, the retirees are a lot of them are related to the people on the line now. They're the fathers, the uncles, the brothers. So there's a real, real problem here, emotionally, morally, sort of philosophically, as to, you know, do we hurt the retirees to save ourselves or do we sacrifice for them?
There's a lot of discussion about healthcare and the anchor that responsible employers face with healthcare costs if they do good packages. This seems emblematic of the problem. You reduce those costs, you shift them on to another payer, namely, the government as single payer. You've dealt with that problem. Do you see any shift in that direction in these negotiations?
Well, the whole issue of government health care, national health care, has been discussed for years in Detroit. And I think, seriously, this may be the point where the Detroit companies and the UAW really kick into high gear to push for that. But before we get to that, there is a solution, which is taking the health care responsibility away from the car companies. They would essentially pay the union to participate in what's called a VEBA trust, where the liability is removed from the car companies, and then the UAW would be responsible for administering the health care costs. And that's something that's been tried at Goodyear. It's also something that's going to go into effect at Dana, which is a bankrupt part supplier. So I would be willing to say that we'll see that long before we see national health care.
Right. High stakes, bleak prospects. Mickey Maynard, Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let's drive from big business in Detroit to big business in media. The future of the Wall Street Journal and its parent company, Dow Jones, may be decided today. The deciders will be the Bancroft family, which holds controlling interest in Dow Jones. On the plate set before them is the $5 billion offer by media mogul Robert Murdoch to buy the company. Last week, the board of Dow Jones voted to approve the deal, but there'll be no deal unless the Bancrofts agree, and they began meeting here in Boston today. The family has controlled Dow Jones since 1902, and some members are concerned that Rupert Murdoch would undermine the Wall Street Journal's reputation for impartial reporting. For more on the possible sale of the Dow Jones, we turn to John Fine, media columnist for Businessweek. Thanks for joining us, John.
Good to be here, David.
John, before we get to the offer, briefly remind us how the Dow Jones company ended up in a position where it needs an outside buyer to survive.
Oh, wow. Where to begin? There are certain things to keep in mind about Dow Jones. Number one, their key property, obviously, is the Wall Street Journal, which is one of the great newspapers of the world of this time, of any time. The other thing to keep in mind about them is that as a company, it's pretty fair to say that the past 20 years, they've just made a series of pretty stupendous blunders, just in terms of management, just in terms of position, just in terms of strategy. They missed a chance in the early 90s to be involved with cable business news. So CNBC ended up running away with that. In the mid-90s, they blew the chance to become the Bloomberg, as it were. They allowed Bloomberg to come in and get into the provision of financial data to people like traders and stock exchange people. And that's an enormously, enormously valuable franchise. They, in turn, tried to compete with Bloomberg with something called Telerate, which, A, was a pretty disastrous. And what's worse is that they spent years chasing it, trying to make it good. And by chasing losses at Telerate, what that did was it prevented them in investing in other places where they might have done better. Mm. The problem with Dow Jones is this. As great a newspaper as the Wall Street Journal is, it's frankly been a fairly poor business for the past several years. And unfortunately, it leaves you vulnerable to someone like Rupert Murdoch, who's clearly not the seller of First Resort, to come in with a huge bid that is very, very difficult to ignore. I mean, the stock was trading at around $36 a share, and he said, I'll give you $60. That tends to get people's attention.
John, in a word, could the Journal survive without a buyer and without massive layoffs?
Could it survive? Well, of course it can survive. But, I mean, you landed on a very good phrase, massive layoffs. The bottom line is the very strange irony of all this, really, is that right now Rupert Murdoch buying Dow Jones is in a lot of ways the least bad option for the Wall Street Journal. Say what you will about Rupert Murdoch. There's a lot to be said about Rupert Murdoch. But Rupert Murdoch loves newspapers. He's been willing to publish prominent newspapers that have been, you know, pretty lousy businesses. The New York Post is his one newspaper in America. No one knows what the exact figure is, but depending on who you talk to, it loses between 20 and 40 million a year.
Those who fear Murdoch's meddling and turning papers into weapons have ample evidence from the investigative reporting. What have the reporters uncovered?
Rupert Murdoch is an old school press baron. He gets interested in his newspapers. I mean, one of the nicest things that people say is that, you know, like his tabloids, his New York Posts, his tabloids in London, which are actually enormously entertaining properties. I mean, they are kind of his toys, and his viewpoint, you know, tends to get reflected within those pages. At his higher tone properties, which would be the Times of London, the Australian, as Borat would say, not so much. But, you know, he's there. I mean, every owner in some way ends up being slightly reflected in some aspect of their newspaper. Again, another irony here is the Wall Street Journal is noted for extremely right-wing editorial page. I mean, shockingly so often. And I would actually suggest that the first section of the Wall Street Journal, which you'd see, where you might see Rupert Murdoch's influence, could be that. Because Rupert Murdoch isn't a hard right-wing ideologue. He's a pragmatist. I mean, this is a guy who spent a lot of time cozying up to Tony Blair. This is a guy who's currently been kind of playing footsie with Hillary Clinton. Sorry if I put a very bad picture in your head with that one, by the way.
No, understood. Understood. And yes, he buys the ink, he buys the paper, and publishers who do that have always made themselves felt. You say pragmatic, though, rather than political. There is the issue, of course, of the Asian satellite system. They dropped the BBC. That was the irritant to the communist Chinese, to Beijing. Mm-hmm. That was seen as a very large use of the media as a weapon and of meddling.
Meddling is an interesting word to use here. I mean, you know, certain times his media properties have been used in pursuit of another of his sort of political pursuits. I mean, having
he's
said
used
that,
them, and not passive, active. He's used them.
Fine. Yeah. Having said that, I would actually suggest to you that to expect that the Wall Street Journal to become an arm of the Fox News Channel and the New York Post, I think that's simply ludicrous, because the value of the Wall Street Journal as a property is not being like that.
Sure.
The Times of London did not become a gutter tabloid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, The Australian is not a gutter tabloid in Australia.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's a range of stuff going on here.
So how does it the acquisition affect the empire?
The Wall Street Journal, and indeed many key American business publications, you know, Business Week included, has had a very tough time breaking into Asia, breaking into Europe from America. News Corp has an entire infrastructure of Europe, of Asia. I mean, he could probably make it work better. There's people on the ground there. There's distribution on the ground. There's obviously satellite systems everywhere. A lot of people mention, and it should be noted, that in October they're launching the Fox Business Channel, which will be a competitor to CNBC in the States, obviously. On the other hand, you could say that, you know, Rupert sees this as a chance to go into Europe, you know, with a really ramped up, you know, Wall Street Journal Europe edition and take on the Financial Times, which is the dominant paper in Europe,
sure.
You know, head on. I suspect that taking on head on is probably more appealing to them.
You've mentioned already what the Wall Street Journal didn't do. Let me flip the question. What did other newspapers do that the Wall Street Journal didn't?
It's not other newspapers, it's other newspaper companies. And in truth, I mean, I would not sit here and try to tell you that every other newspaper company utterly covered themselves with glory, and that's why they're doing so great, because, you know, in truth, very few of them are. But, for instance, the Washington Post company did a very smart thing. They diversified the income that was coming off the newspaper, and they bought up educational properties. So they diversified into a business that is much less under attack right now. The New York Times has tried to do other things. I'd say the New York Times has actually been better about ramping up their offerings on the web. The New York Times' website is actually really quite a fabulous thing. A lot of video, just a lot of stuff,
sure.
And just a really good experience in ways that the Wall Street Journal isn't.
Let's talk about what the Washington Post has done. Mm-hmm. They've just launched a website called loudandextra.com.
Yes, very good point. The Loudon thing that you're talking about is it's essentially a neighborhood newspaper on the web.
And that neighborhood newspaper on the web concept is called hyperlocal. In this case, it's Loudoun County, Virginia. Could you give us your take on how hyperlocal could help the newspaper industry?
What the Washington Post is doing is very interesting. I commend them on it. Doing hyperlocal on the web hasn't worked anywhere that well yet. That's not to say it won't, but it just hasn't quite worked out yet. I would predict that actually the hyperlocal newspaper is going to be one of the last things standing. But a lot of people have been trying to do something with it for several years, and it hasn't really worked out anywhere yet.
Well, your assessment's going to be good news for our next guest, Rob Curley of LoudonExtra.com. John Fine, media columnist for Business Week, talking to us about the possible sale of Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal to media mogul Rupert Murdoch. Thanks for joining us, John.
My pleasure, David.
When we come back, we'll find out what hyperlocal journalism is all about and how the Washington Post plans to succeed where others have failed. And later in the show, a couple of teens fill us in all about Harry. Harry Potter, that is. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm David Boeri, sitting in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today we're talking about the changing media landscape with the possible sale of Dow Jones and its Wall Street Journal newspaper to Rupert Murdoch. If the sale goes through, Murdoch is expected to sell off Dow Jones' chain of local community newspapers. At the same time, a new trend is emerging, something called hyper-local news, where the big story could be a lost cat, a new pizza joint opening down the street, even what the pastor has on schedule for Sunday services. The Washington Post launched the latest hyper-local venture this month, called LoudonExtra.com. It covers the affluent community of Loudoun County, Virginia, and it's the first of several hyper-local sites the Post plans to launch. Rob Curley is heading the project and joins us with more. Welcome, Rob.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, Rob, you just heard John Fine of Business Week say that he thought the hyperlocals would be the last thing standing, but so far, most of them haven't worked out. How do you intend to keep yours working?
Well, I think our strategy at the Washington Post is quite different than what a lot of other hyperlocal sites have tried. A lot of these local sites have went one of two routes. They've either went with lots of community publishing tools where readers could upload photos, stories, those sorts of things, or they've went with lots of public records databases. And what we're trying to do is much more of, yes, we have really great community publishing tools. Yes, we have lots of public records databases, but we also have lots of databases that we've created on our own. Every restaurant in town was called, and you know, we built a database where if you're hungry for steak at midnight, we can tell you where to go. Or we visited every church in town, we visited every school, tons of pictures, those sorts of things. But to me, the killer app here is not the databases or the community publishing. It's the news, and we have real reporters, real journalists there covering everything. A lot of the hyperlocal strategies, I think, have been missing a really key important, a really key element, which was the journalism. And what we're trying to do is add that sense to it. You know, databases don't do any good if there's a huge fire in town. And when there's a huge fire in town, I guarantee you loudandextra.com will have it.
Rob, how hyper is hyper? Tell us what the local news is now.
The big event in Loudoun is the Loudoun County Fair, and we're going to be there every day. We're going to be posting stories. We're going to be posting photo galleries. We've got video clips. We have the results of every baking contest and every livestock competition. We'll be able to tell you who won the demolition derby.
You say that you have real reporters, Washington Post reporters, and you're also going to be relying on what's been called a citizen army of bloggers and amateur contributors. How are you going to mix the two, meld the two in a professional news setting?
Well, we've got a lot of tricks up our sleeve for the community publishing tools. We're going to handle it very differently than other news organizations have. What we're doing is using the content that comes from our readers and having editors look at them so that we put them in the right kind of content buckets. So that's one way, but it's clearly separated from the Washington Post journalism and the community submitted journalism. But I have this gut feeling that won't always be the case. Whether it's a great news story or a horrible news story, horrible accident or something, where the best photos are coming from our readers, not from our reporters, because our readers would have been on the scene. You know, the Washington Post has a bureau of five or six people in Loudoun, and there are 300,000 people in Loudoun. I mean, who is more likely to see one of these events, the 300,000 people or the five reporters? So when one of these big events happen, what I think you'll see happen is a real combination of the coverage that was done by our reporters along with the stuff that was captured at the scene from our readers.
Rob, you've worked in local papers. Why are local papers struggling?
The smaller newspapers aren't failing. I mean, Could it happen? Yes. I mean, it's these metro papers that are really having problems right now. You know, you go to these newspaper conferences, and I guarantee you there's going to be a publisher who raises his hand saying, look, I know that there are problems in L.A. and Washington and New York, but you know what? I'm not seeing it in Salina, Kansas right now. You know, my business is as strong as it's ever been. My readership is strong. There's not the huge competition in these smaller markets. So I would have to disagree. I think that the community newspapers are doing very well, at least compared to their big brother counterparts in top 30 or top 40 markets.
But one of the problems with the local papers is, in my case, a paper that was owned by a family in that town for years and years, the conglomerates have come in, and all these papers are getting bought up by chains, such as the Dow Jones chain. So one of the bad effects of conglomerate ownership is you got a different page one and everything else is the same. But for the hyperlocals, you couldn't do that and succeed, or could you?
I don't think you could. I mean, the commitment really has to be local. I mean, for us, we've went, you know, as local, if not more local, with Loudoun compared to any other site we've ever built. That being the case, we still wonder every day if we've went local enough. I mean, it's so hard to me that these newspaper companies have to start realizing that they have to build websites that work the way the Internet really works. And that's so hard for these people. I'll give you an example. In Loudoun alone, there are already, I think, you know, almost 90 Facebook groups related to Loudoun.
Wow.
That, to me, is phenomenal, you know. And to me, that means, you know, when we come to the party, we really better have something special because these people were being underserved, and they started serving themselves.
You know, Loudoun, you have median household incomes close to $100,000 a year. Does the income of that county, that area, affect hyperlocal? Do you think you can do hyperlocals in less affluent communities as well?
Absolutely. When you look at the things that we have held up as important in Loudoun, they're the exact same things that we think are important regardless of how much your household income is or how far your commute is. you know, whether the schools are safe, when the third grade holiday program is. I mean, if you have a third grader, that's important whether you make $30,000 or $100,000.
I think you can find the ad revenues even to tailor less affluent communities.
You know, it's very interesting for me. The Lawrence Journal World, which is a 19,000 circ newspaper in a town of 80,000 people, has an online operation that's generating $2 million a year. I think that there is money there, and I think it's a very good business to be in.
Good business to be in. We don't hear that very often when people are talking about newspapers these days. Rob Curley is Vice President of Product Development for the Washington Post Newsweek Interactive. Thanks for joining us, Rob.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, as they sit down in Baghdad for talks in Iraq, we examine the delicate relationship between Iran and the U.S. Also, a new twist on Indian music with a dance beat. Tabla player Sufula goes from Bhangra to bop and hip-hop. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, the story of three teenagers who will be tried as adults in a horrific sexual assault case at West Palm Beach, Florida. Here and Now. I'm David Boeri. It's Here and Now. In West Palm Beach, Florida, three boys have been arrested and charged as adults in what police describe as a savage and cruel attack upon a woman and her son in a local housing project. The case has attracted national attention because of both the alleged brutality and the age of those arrested. The defendants are 14, 15, and 16. We should warn you that the details and some of the account of what happened or allegedly happened are disturbing. According to police and prosecution, a group of masked intruders beat a 35-year-old woman in her home, raped her multiple times, even using a gun, and then by holding a gun to her head, forced her to engage in sex with her son, age 12. He, too, was beaten, and the intruders poured household chemicals in his eyes and on his mother's body. The intruders also took pictures, allegedly using their cell phones, according to the mother, who spoke to a local reporter. The woman says no one in the Dunbar Village housing project responded to their screams and calls for help, and she and her son had to walk to the hospital after the attackers left the housing project. Rochelle Gilkin is a reporter for the Palm Beach Post covering this story, and she joins us now. Rochelle, thanks for joining us.
Sure, no problem.
And with the understanding the sensitivity and the details, the sordid details, tell us, if you would, how are police and prosecutors describing what happened that night?
The police officers that we've talked to from day one talk about this case as being, you know, one of the worst cases they've ever seen, and a unique case that they've never seen, this kind of brutality, this kind of effort made to hurt people. The prosecutors said that they've never seen a case like this before either.
Sometimes we can suspect that prosecutors engage in hyperbole for obvious self-interest here in pushing the case forward, but there does seem to be some hard physical evidence that they have that's incriminating, yes?
Well, the evidence that they've talked about so far that they've reported to make the arrest they've already come up with sounds like pretty good evidence. They have DNA evidence, they have fingerprint evidence that they collected at the scene, and that's how they got those first three arrests. They say they have more evidence, more forensics that they're going to be able to use to make more arrests. So they really are indicating they have a strong case. Whether that's true will come out in court.
It's a housing project, Dunbar Village is. We don't think of housing projects when we think of Palm Beach.
No, we don't. But, you know, there's housing projects everywhere, and there's housing projects in West Palm Beach. And it isn't that far from some of the more affluent neighborhoods. But this is one where, you know, very low income, relatively high crime area.
Associated Press quotes one woman who lives in Dunbar Village as saying, "So a lady was raped, big deal. There's too much other crime here."
Mm-hmm.
It suggests an indifference that's there amongst the people who are living there.
It does, and I don't think that's the intention. I think that if you talk to people there, they will talk about a fear of retaliation. They will talk about their desire to stay out of it. But it's not so much that they have an indifference toward it, so much as they've accepted that that's the way life is. And, you know, that quote, and I didn't get that quote, I didn't talk to her, but my understanding from people there is that they see this as one crime that's horrible, but that it's indicative of other things that have happened there, that this didn't happen just out of the blue, that there's been other shootings, other stabbings, other violence, and And they're trying to point that out as opposed to just focusing on this one crime, pointing out that this didn't happen in a vacuum. This happened, and there's other things that happened that should have also affected people and gotten them to do something, and people didn't do things in response to it.
In some of this, there will be the familiar to reporters covering inner-city violence. The teenagers who have been arrested so far, what we know, apparently, what you've reported, the mother of one of those defendants says she herself was raped twice as a child. Another defendant had a sister who killed the father of her child, pled guilty to manslaughter. One of the defendants quit school after failing three times in the seventh grade.
Yeah.
What does this tell you about those defendants?
Well, they all had interaction with police before this happened. So they all had gotten into some trouble before, and they all had bad experiences in their lives. Most people don't experience that kind of thing. And so they've already all experienced some sort of violence in their lives and instability and the lack of education. It still begs the question, what could have brought them to the point of this crime?
What's interesting here is there's a piece last Thursday in your paper that 1 month after that attack on the mother and the son, entry gate is still broken, the street lights remain dim, police security camera has not been installed, and a system to identify residents' cars is only partially enforced. One wonders if that would have been the response if this had happened on the other side of town, on the Ridge area, in the waterfront area.
You know, it's a good question. In this case, I know that they had been planning security upgrades there for a long time. You know, all the politicians have talked about it. The mayor has said that we need more activities for children. And, you know, maybe this is the crime that will propel people to do something. People are outraged at what happened. I think people have been, this has been a very highly publicized crime. And it has gotten people to really talk about it and look at what's going on there and spend time there and try to figure out what can be done.
What's happened to the mother and the son in this case?
They moved out, obviously, of the housing project. They are in an apartment where they feel safer from what's been reported by their family and friends, and they're getting counseling.
Is there any indication police are still looking for suspects, that they believe that there are more than the three defendants who allegedly were involved in the crime?
Yes. The woman, the victim, told police that she thought there were 10 attackers. So at this point, that's what they're saying, is that there are as many as 10. They do have information linking other suspects to the case, and they do expect to make more arrests. They haven't done that yet. So we're checking every day just to see when the next arrest will come.
Do police feel that the savagery of the attack might be linked to either a gang initiation or to some other factor that hasn't been reported here?
You know, we've talked to the police about possible motives. We've talked to people in the community about possible motives. And at this point, everything people say is just pure speculation. None of the teenagers, when they were interviewed by police, offered a motive of why this might have been done. So at this point, everybody's guessing that, you know, maybe it was a gang initiation. Maybe it was retaliation for something she did or said, or something her son did or said. But nobody's been able to pinpoint it. They're just guessing, because they're thinking there has to be some reason why she was picked, some reason why they would have done this kind of thing.
Perhaps because she was more vulnerable than others? Haitian immigrant, as I understand.
That's another possibility, that it was a crime of opportunity. It's anyone's guess. I have no idea. And the police have not given any indication that they know what the possible motive was.
Rochelle Gilkin is a reporter for the Palm Beach Post. Rochelle, thanks for speaking with us.
No problem.
Just a reminder, you can hear our show anytime on our website, here-now.org. All our past programs are there, too, in our archives. You can also download a podcast of our broadcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Looking for a cheap corkscrew? A discount on a power drill? Well, one place to find a deal may be your state surplus property store. The reason? It's been nearly 6 years since 9/11. And despite government warnings about what you can and can't take on an airplane these days, the message doesn't seem to be getting through. Last year, airport agents collected 1.6 million knives and blades, more than 12,000 clubs, bats, and bludgeons, and 74,000 other objects classified as deadly or dangerous. And many of these items are now for sale at the state's Division of Surplus Property. Joining us are Steve Eakin, who runs the state of Georgia's Surplus Property Division, and Kenneth Hess, who has that same job in Pennsylvania at the Bureau of Supplies and Surplus Operations. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
So let's do a little inventory, Mr. Hess. What are some of the more surprising items you're finding at airports these days?
Well, we have what we refer to as the Wall of Fame. We have a pretty nice rack of deer antlers than I have ever shot.
Deer antlers?
Deer antlers, certainly. We have a real, genuine hand grenade that somebody drilled a hole in the bottom and melted the plastic explosive out of. So I can certainly see where you'd want to travel with one of those in your handbag. Blenders, we seem to be having a real run on blenders. We figure
mixed drinks during flight? What's that about?
Well, it may be that you have to have your pina colada on your vacation, so you're taking your blender with you to make it just the way you like it. But, of course, those sharp blades in the bottom are a big no-no.
A foot-long fishing hook.
Yeah, that was a fourth place at a fishing competition at Cayuga Lake, which is in southern New York State. And I could only wonder, after looking at this hook, what the hell would you have gotten for first place?
Mr. Eakin.
Yes.
Can you top that?
I don't think so, honestly. We just get the mundane stuff like swords and power drills and Makita trim saws. We haven't really had any taxidermy stuff come through Atlanta.
Golf clubs? Pool cues?
Baseball bats? Yes, all of that.
And these are all carry-on items, right, Mr. Eakin?
Yes, and the thing that surprises me is like 10-pound dumbbells. I understand folks want to exercise on their vacation and stuff, but who wants to lug 20 pounds of dead weight in their carry-on?
Hey, Steve, I got to tell you, we got a great promotion on dumbbells that we run in December, and we call it our New Year's resolution special, where we'll kit half-pound, one-pound, three-pound, five-pound, 10-pound dumbbells and send them as a self-improvement mechanism.
So how do you market the goods down in Atlanta?
Well, down here, we actually have retail stores for all of our surplus property. And here in Georgia, we weren't trying to make a profit on other people's misfortune. We just wanted to have a way to make it available for them to come back and get it.
And Mr. Hess, what are you doing to market the stuff up in Pennsylvania?
We rely on eBay to market our goods. We've done about 5,000 transactions on eBay and maintain a 99.8% satisfaction rating.
How much money are you bringing in?
Since we started the program in June of 2004, we've made $380,000.
Shampoo, toothpaste, gels, those sorts of things, I can understand people inadvertently bringing them through the airport, giving them up. But guns, knives, chainsaws, why are people still attempting to bring these items onto planes?
I think the smaller items, the corkscrews and the pocket knives, I mean, if you've always carried a pocket knife, you get up in the morning, you put your stuff in your pocket, you just always have it. And I think people just legitimately forget about it.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I have started quite a collection of auto parts recently, however. I have multiple sets of brake rotors, drums, fuel pumps. My theory is you got a salesman traveling with a demo, and maybe he was driving a car and got news that he had to come home, so he's hopping a plane one way, and he has nothing to lose by trying to take this stuff. Otherwise, I simply cannot imagine why somebody's trying to drag their fuel pump onto the airplane with them.
Kenneth Hess heads Pennsylvania's Bureau of Supplies and Surplus Operations, and Steve Eakins runs Georgia's Surplus Property Division. To see a list of prohibited and permitted items for air travelers, go to our website, here-now.org. Gentlemen, thanks for your time today, and stay on the line, will you? I want to talk to you about looking for my money belt and this Gerber fishing knife. It's about 5 inches long and black.
Sure. We'll be happy to look for it.
Good luck, gentlemen.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you later, Ken. Bye.
Coming up, a kid's eye review of the last Harry Potter book, here and now. I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Thank you all for coming. You all rock. Once again, Harry and the Potters. We just love Harry Potter so much that we decided to come out and celebrate tonight.
It's the last year, and we decided to do it in the best way possible.
Yeah,
it's the best. It's the best in, like, the world, basically. Yeah.
Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, transformed into Hogwarts Academy this weekend, one of countless Harry Potter events around the world, to celebrate the release of J.K. Rowling's seventh and final Harry Potter tome, The Deathly Hallows. And sales are anything but deathly. In the first 24 hours, 8.3 million copies were sold in the U.S. alone. So now for the good stuff. Is Professor Snape really evil? Do Ron and Hermione fall in love? And most importantly, does Harry Potter die? What, you think we're going to give you the answers? Forget about it. Not even an imperious curse by you-know-who will get the secrets out of us. But we've assembled this panel of experts to share their thoughts on the end of the Harry Potter series. Joining us is Sherry Eskin, children's librarian at the Hone and Alston branch of the Boston Public Library. Welcome, Sherry.
Hi, thank you.
And also in the studio are two young adults who grew up with Harry Potter books, 18-year-old Carrie Malloy.
Hello.
And Andrew Baker, who turned 17 today. Andrew, the same birthday as Harry Potter star Danielle Radcliffe.
Hey, what's up?
How long did it take you two to read the book?
To actually read it was probably about 23 hours, but it took me about 30 hours total because I did have to eat and sleep at some point.
And you, Andrew?
About 10, yeah.
So we should say you're not exactly impartial reviewers. Carrie is dressed as Hermione.
I have my Hogwarts robes, I have my black pleated skirt and my little blouse, and my gray knee socks, and of course you can't be complete without a wizard's hat and a wand. And I kind of look a lot like Hermione, especially with my bushy hair.
Let's get down to business. Sherry Eskin, for the uninitiated, if there is someone in a salt mine in Siberia with no reference to Amazon or libraries, tell us, bring us to speed on the Harry Potter storyline.
Well, the biggest thing that's happening in this book is that Harry and his best friends, Ron and Hermione, are on a quest to find all the Horcruxes.
Okay, again, the people in the salt mine, think about them. What are the Horcruxes?
The Horcruxes are parts of Voldemort's soul. Voldemort is the Dark Lord, and he has separated them out into various places, and in order to destroy Voldemort, you've got to destroy all of the parts of his soul.
Did it live up to its hype?
It had a lot going on. There was some sentimentality that I know Harry Potter fans were looking for. And there was I felt it was very cinematic, like a lot of Rowling's books, a lot of action. But also in this book, there's a lot of hanging around. They're not at Hogwarts. They're not going to school. There isn't that great sense of no matter what happens, they're going to have to come back and go to potions class. There's a lot of just sort of being out in the world by themselves. I'd consider a successful last episode. Everything was wound up perfectly.
Okay, let's get to Andrew and Carrie. You both faithfully have your books open. We asked you to read a passage from the book, something that doesn't give away key plot lines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, why don't you start?
But they were not living, thought Harry. They were gone. The empty words could not disguise the fact that his parents' moldering remains lay beneath snow and stone, indifferent, unknowing. And tears came before he could stop them, boiling hot, then instantly freezing on his face. And what was the point in wiping them off or pretending? He let them fall, his lips pressed hard together, looking down at the thick snow, hiding from his eyes the place where the last of Lily and James lay, bones now, surely, or dust, not knowing or caring that their living son stood so near, his heart still beating, alive because of their sacrifice, and close to wishing at this moment that he was sleeping under the snow with them.
Referring to his dead parents. And why did you like that passage, Andrew?
You know, it just speaks volumes of what Harry has to go through in this book, you know, revisiting his dead parents again.
Carrie, you have a different section, passage marked. Why don't you read that?
A bright silver light appeared right ahead of him, moving through the trees. Whatever the source, it was moving soundlessly. The light seemed to simply drift towards him. He jumped to his feet, his voice frozen in his throat, and raised Hermione's wand. He screwed up his eyes as the light became blinding, the trees in the front of it, pitch black in silhouette, and still the thing came closer. Then the source of the light stepped out from behind an oak. It was a silver-white doe, moon-bright, dazzling, picking her way over the ground, still silent and leaving no hoof prints in the fine powdering snow. She stepped towards him, her beautiful head with its wide, long lashed eyes held high.
Tell me a little bit about that passage and why you like it.
I like it because, again, it speaks to Rowling's talent as a writer, and also it is a very touching moment, and you'll see later on that this doe is very important, and just the way she describes this doe, it's so beautiful, and it really does touch Harry.
Sherry, there's a lot of death and darkness. How do parents deal with kids when it comes to this book?
What Rowling has done is that she's grown the series with her character, so that the first book was appropriate for an 11-year-old. This last book is appropriate for a 17-year-old. And 17-year-olds do like to read about darkness and about death, and that's okay. If you're reading it with a 9-year-old, a big 9-year-old fan, you've got to read it together and you've got to discuss every little thing because you don't want your 9-year-old to have nightmares. And it might happen. Harry deals with a lot of stuff, and I think that's what you need, just constant discussion.
Just looking over the series, like you can see, as Harry grows up, it gets a little darker and a little darker. And I started reading as a 12-year-old the first two books, and I'm glad that I'm now this age when I'm reading this, because if I read this as an 11 or 12-year-old, I don't know how I'd feel.
Well, what was it like growing up with these books and now looking at the prospect of having no more?
Growing up with these books was an excellent experience, because I really feel like I've grown up with them. Like, I felt the angst that he had in book 5. I felt just kind of getting your first crush even in, like, when you're 15 years old. Like, you experience it all, and Rowling describes her characters like no other, and it's been an honor to grow up with them.
Sherry, has Rowling's gotten to be a better writer in the course of this? Has she grown as a writer?
I think she has. Her descriptions have gotten more beautiful. I think her writing has definitely grown up. I think what she conceived of as a children's book has become a book for all, and I think she is writing for the greater population now. And therefore, her writing has gotten better.
There's a letdown now. What are your readers? You don't expect to have fewer readers coming into the library to get books now.
No. Well, I mean, my job is to encourage other things. And it's always been my job when kids finish a Harry Potter book and say, what can I read next? Every good librarian has her mental list of books. This is what you can read next.
Kerry, at 18 going on 19, what are you reading and what do you suggest people turn to now?
What I suggest people turn to now is any book, honestly, because Harry opened my eyes to reading. I hated reading before, and now I'll read a lot, and I think people should just open up to any reading. Me in particular, my aunt recently gave me a book about the Oklahoma Dust Bowl, and I'm kind of starting that probably after I am satisfied reading through this about 2 or 3 more times.
Excellent. The Dust Bowl in Oklahoma. Well, you're about to go to college.
I'm a sophomore at BU.
Terrific. A lot of kids at BU reading this book?
Oh, I'd say so, yeah. I know of a few Harry Potter fans at BU just right off the top of my head, and if BU doesn't have a Harry Potter club, you know I'm going to be founding one.
Okay, that's Kerry Molloy. Sherry Eskin is the children's librarian of the Hone and Alston branch of the Boston Public Library, 18-year-old Kerry Molloy, BU student, and 17-year-old Andrew Baker. Happy birthday. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm just wild about Harry. Harry's wild about me. The heavenly blizzard of his kisses fill me with ecstasy. He's sweet just like chocolate candy, and he's like honey from the bee.
The honey bee.
Oh, I'm just wild about Harry. Harry's wild about I can't live without Harry's wild about me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm David Boeri, and now that you're all finished with Harry, join us again, Here and Now.
The heavenly blisses of his kisses fill me with ecstasy.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.